Hi, welcome to the GovLab podcast. GovLab is the innovation brand of Deloitte Public Sector. Together with public sector organizations, we try to solve society's most wicked problems through innovation. In this podcast series, we talk to innovators that have the ambition to change our society and make it a bit better place to live in. What drives them? How do they do it? And what can we learn from them? Today we speak with Mario Kortman, former Chief Digital Officer of Waternet and nowadays working as a manager within Deloitte.
Hi, welcome. Maybe you can shortly start with introduce yourself. Who are you and what are your missions?
So my name is Mario Kortman. I've just joined Deloitte since the 1st of March from the top of my head, and I've joined as a manager in the Agile and Digital Transformations practice. And before that, I worked as a Chief Digital Officer or Director of Digitalization at Waternet, which is a part of the city of Amsterdam.
Okay, and can you maybe tell a little bit about Waternet? Because I think that a lot of listeners don't know exactly what Waternet is and what it does.
Yeah. I'm usually quite confident in saying that almost everyone on this planet knows the core product of Waternet, which is, apart from drinking water, the Amsterdam canals. So Waternet maintains levees, dikes, and everything related to the water levels in and around Amsterdam, of which the Amsterdam canals are obviously a very famous and visible part. And they produce drinking water, produce clean energies, filter sewage water, etc. So it's roughly everything that has a relation to the water cycle for in and about 1.5 million people in the region of Amsterdam.
Okay, and you were Chief Digital Officer. What kind of like digital things do they have, and what was your?
So there are, in general terms, three core areas that Waternet recognizes: that the world is digitizing at such a fast pace that they need to alter the way the company is organized and alter the way digitization is made a core practice of what we're doing, or what they're doing. It's not that long ago. In a general sense. So the three main areas are the way we support and handle our employees. The second one is the way we support and handle the way we interact with our customers. And the third one is the way we support and handle the way we interact with our assets. And to Waternet, assets are factories where we make drinking water or clean energy or whatever. Employees are obviously the employer base, and customers are these 1.5 million people that live in the region of Amsterdam. And on all of these areas, you see that digitalization, so the increasingly more important digital dimension of the world around us, becomes so vital to the way Waternet interacts with its surroundings that you need to organize yourself in such a different way that you're able to incorporate this digital imperative for this digital change.
Okay, can you tell me maybe a little bit of how you dealt with that? So how did you set up the program, or what?
Well, in terms of impact, there are two vivid examples. The first is Waternet has roughly 8,000 kilometers of transport pipes that they use to transport water from A to B. And these 8,000 kilometers is everything from 15 days to 150 years old. So if you're planning maintenance, then you're really interested in knowing what the condition of this 8,000 kilometers of pipes is. Obviously, this is completely impossible from a manual perspective point of view. You can't inspect, apart from that they're below ground, but you can't inspect these 8,000 kilometers. So you need smarter algorithms or smarter ways. We used IoT, sensor technology, to predict instead of respond to where failures are going to happen or where your maintenance crews are needed in order to become more proactive and lower the cost of your overall maintenance cycle. So that's a very technical part where digitalization really impacted the way Waternet is organized and organized its main process, which is maintaining these pipes and other technical installations. The other part is Amsterdam in particular, citizens have a tendency of growing ever more critical and ever more involved in the day-to-day operations of their government, which is, to my opinion, a good thing. I'm paying the government roughly half of my salary at the beginning of the year. I'm allowed to have an opinion on how they organize themselves, and I'm allowed to have a certain expectation of what they're going to deliver. So just merely updating your website once a month or even companies out there that do it even less is by far not close enough to a full-scale digital government experience that, that people expect and that you should deliver as government. So that is where digitalization really came into play when we found a way to incorporate user feedback or customer expectations into a rapidly evolving customer platform. Because most of the interaction between customers in Amsterdam and the Waternet organization was via digital channels. No one likes to take their day off to stand in a line to be helped poorly or good. That's not really, really relevant, but to invest so much time in such a small administrative interaction, such as paying your bill or altering some data, something like that. So this should all be digital. And in order to be successful digital and in a customer area, you need to incorporate user feedback very fast. So predictive maintenance on the one hand, and IoT demands something technical of the organization and went in the direction of how to integrate digital in the core of our process that we're doing for 150 years, but it's really changing because of this this digitalization. And the other part is how to become a responsive organization to a surrounding that expects ever more from you every day.
And how did you went on with this? So did you design a program, a strategy, or what was the first steps that you took? Like,
I firmly believe that in order to adapt to an ever-changing world, you need to be able to learn fast. So when starting with a big change, you better start with learning what went wrong or what went right in the changes that were beforehand. So before we started, we evaluated all key projects and programs designed to transform parts of our business or parts of our IT landscape, and found that a clogged project portfolio, a lack of ownership or a lack of urgency towards key projects usually triggered project failure, either complete or partial. And this is not a Waternet unique case, this is a general case to almost every large IT projects portfolio that you're going to find at almost any organization that I'm willing to bet that dares to publicly admit that this is the case. And in the key sense, this, to my opinion, ended on the notion that people didn't feel responsible for understanding the ever-changing world. So lots of new skills were required, but that's not my problem because I'm here and already doing my job. So who expects of me to connect with the world around me? That's one. And the other one is that they also didn't felt the responsibility or the possibility to act to the projects that they were currently working on. So they had no sense of ownership, but also no possibility of ownership towards the things that they were actually working on. So they were not connecting with the world and they were not given room or responsibility or being managed to actually translate this world into what you're doing today. And the way of fixing that, we traveled to Microsoft and to Spotify and to several other big tech corporations that are really influenced by an ever-changing customer base in the last decade, was Agile. Was a very simple, basic organizational model designed to promote cooperation across all business lines or across all specializations like IT and marketing and what have you, and make not so much the customer, but the fact that the world is changing rapidly and will continue to change, the core of the way that you do your projects or programs or what type of clustering that you want to use to label work. So the idea of using a very simple organizational model like Agile or Agile Scrum would be used variants and making this all about being able to respond to a changing world instead of using scope or governance to push it out. That was the key of our transformation.
And can you elaborate a little bit about how did you have a vision about how this Agile and Scrum needs to be implemented in your organization? How should it have looked like when you were done? Or
When you recognize that the world is digitalizing at a rapid pace, and this will probably mean a continuously changing world for the following decades, then there's obviously no such thing as being done. It's just a thing as being responsive enough to feel somewhat in control of the change that is overflowing you. But what we set out to enact was based on the Agile principles. So principles that revolve around cooperation, around shared ownership, around short times to result, and a large capacity to incorporate feedback within the next iteration of your project or product or program. And the more we were able to work along the lines of those principles, the further we found ourselves to be in our transformation, if there's such a thing.
Yeah, but how did you start it off? Because I know I've seen a lot of organizations, almost all organizations also here within Deloitte, we want to cooperate, we want to work together, develop faster, etc. But often it's still difficult. So how did you start? Like, did you start small with one team or?
Well, we started with the idea that you should only bring to this change what you actually need. So we started with a blank space. So there were no assumptions or as little as possible about what an organization needs to function. So we started with a complete greenfield with one basic agile team that in the initial stage is just where the basic agile configuration of a product owner, a multidisciplinary team, and sort of a coach or scrum master. And even when we started scaling up teams to incorporate bigger parts of our change portfolio or our IT portfolio, we only added roles that like product managers or planners when they were absolutely necessary. So absolutely necessary means when we were failing without. So even though we had, information architects, we only onboarded information architects after 2 years, because only after 2 years we were at the maturity level that you actually need architecture instead of have architects that write lots of paper and that make it feel that they are needed. So only the results that what at the end of the sprint was delivered were guiding us in what type of organization that we should erect in order to increase the way we iterate on the results of the previous sprints. So that started quite radical in that sense. It was quite a minimalistic, principle-based vision of organizations, which made it a lot easier to communicate because it's very different and it's very easy to explain. Well, everything is different, so this is how it roughly works, and we're kind of finding out how it will change. And you know that as we use the agile cadence or agile rhythm to evaluate and set new goals, that every 2 weeks we will decide again whether we need to scale up the organization or this minimal model works just fine. But which is in the government roughly a completely opposite approach to how projects are usually involved, because involvement means, well, everyone should be involved, and you have this Dutch thing called draagvlak, which is roughly translated as when you want to translate in a positive sense, it means cooperative shared responsibility. So everyone feels a desire to work together. When you translate it in a negative sense, it means those that don't want to change blackmail the rest to feel somehow obliged to incorporate their particular version of the change that they see fit. And otherwise, there's no draagvlak, so you're out. That's a thing that stirs a whole lot of allergy in my personal book. So I like to keep it simple from a greenfield perspective, and then iterate your way as you go.
But did you then start on certain domains, or how like?
No, we just started where it was easiest.
And then there was
at front end. So front end development of a website is technically relatively simple. It's a place where Agile is a very proven method. Almost all big website design firms use it. So it was a quite a clear-cut example where Agile wouldn't immediately came across all kind of hurdles that we lacked experience to tackle. And obviously this triggers a very common change response. Yes, but how will this work? And then some very specific example of something that sounds impossible in the first on the first hearing, which is to which the answer is I have absolutely no clue. That's the thing that we're trying to find out, obviously, but we're not going to start finding out how hard it is to ride a Tour de France by starting on a racing bike. We're starting on a very simple bike with these little side wheels that enable us to learn to cycle first, and then in a few iterations we can start thinking about the Tour de France. So we started at a very easy place, front-end development, where it's really easy to incorporate user feedback. Lots of users feel something about a front-end or already give you feedback by not visiting pages that you would like them to, and it's very easy to show to your board or to your stakeholders that Agile can be cheap, that it can be cheap to not rework your designs because you incorporate testing within the sprint, to not build a giant project that has no clicked with customers because you only went live once a year instead of once every 2 weeks. So it's a sort of a fail-safe way to start, which is a healthy thing in a greenfield, because greenfields are already complex enough for everyone involved.
And then, because for these kind of things, often the leadership needs to be involved. How was the leadership of Waternet involved in this project?
Well, this varied across the phase. And in the beginning, obviously, this was a small experiment because it started with just something on the front end. And they said, well, this is your own mandate as a program manager. Please do and tell us only very little about it because you don't find it to be very interesting. That's, of course, a bit of an exaggeration, but it started with a relatively large amount of freedom. And it ended at the point where Waternet decided to tip all running IT projects, all running IT organizations, and most of the business organization into one giant scaled Agile framework. And obviously that's the part where board involvement needs to be very big, because you're completely redesigning a large part of the company. But along the way, it started, so it ended with the Tour de France, but it started with just a very small bike and someone that fell over the first 3 times, because Agile can be really hard when you don't understand where to start or when you lack the experience in the greenfield to get going really good.
But what was there from the start, a kind of resistance also from the standing organization, or was it so small that people thought, well, just out there, just let them play? And
I don't think that resistance is a concept. So you have behavior, people display behavior, which can be behavior such as controlling behavior or not giving you the mandate or not being supportive towards whatever you're exempting. And most of these behaviors are usually triggered by fear, especially in government organizations, where even though people work there for a very long time and it feels like a very safe organization, fear can be a very dominant part in the way people perceive new things. Fear for not understanding what it will mean to them, or fear that they will be left out. When you manage fear, that's not something that you want to do in the same way as you would manage the thing that I think doesn't exist, which is resistance. Resistance tends to be managed with keeping to repeat yourself about what you aiming to achieve, which is marginally relevant to the people, to the person actually resisting. And fear is something that you manage by asking the other, what is it that you're afraid of, and can we fix it in some way? If I'm afraid that our information architecture will falter because Agile means that we're doing random things, I can assure you, because building something and deciding to go live can be very different things, even in Agile. And we can incorporate you in the decision making about when to go live. But that's not the same thing as somehow managing resistance by either shutting down, for instance, information architecture, or by ignoring their fears and just starting to talk ever more loudly about what you aim to achieve as a change manager. So yes, obviously the organization responded in a pattern that most people call resistance, but no, that's not something that I think that you should manage in a way different than you should manage fear in your team.
And were you able to, in that kind of management way, did everybody go with you? So, or were there in the end some people that were like left behind in the sense that they didn't believe in the way you worked? But
one of the key fears in a government organization is being left out. And so if we designed an Agile rollout or an Agile transformation that somehow leaves people out, then probably wouldn't have made it very far. So in a general sense, no. In a specific sense, so were there a few people along the way, to my knowledge, 9 or 10, that thought, well, this is not for me, goodbye, I'm going somewhere else. Yes, obviously, but that's a very healthy thing. That's something that you should do in any situation, whether it's your work or your relationship at home or whatever. But we started with one team consisting of, I think, 10 to 15 people, which was too big, but that's how we started. And we ended with somewhere around 40 teams. So that's including supporting staff, roughly 400 full-time people. So they didn't really run away along the lines.
And they were all working now in this new agile way.
Yeah, and because the basic model didn't really change. A team, a product owner, a Scrum Master, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and what did it bring to Waternet? Like,
I think, well, for instance, at the customer department. So Waternet had a website before we started that attracted, I think, somewhere around 4,000 visitors a month that were interested in doing digital business with Waternet, so paying their bills by themselves instead of us needing to put them in an envelope and send them to them, which is obviously quite quite costly. As we have 1.5 million customers, 1.5 million times all these envelopes is even more costly. When I left Waternet, roughly 90% of all customers regularly use the website, and even more than 60% of 80 years and older. So even more than 60% of all 80 years and older in Amsterdam, and we were able to measure this quite well, used the website because we had also designed a variant of the website that used on their iPad, or in some cases that we gave on an iPad to the mailman and asked the mailman to help senior citizens to fill in digital forms about how they prefer to pay or how they prefer to be contacted with. So really tailoring digitalization towards the different user groups, in the end propelled, I think our monthly visitors when I left was roughly around 400,000 to 600,000 successful logins, not visitors, because that's quite irrelevant to measure, but successful logins a month. So 20 to 30% of our customer base visited our website each month. And I think almost 87 or 80% of all transactions, so all questions, all bills paid, all revenue generated, so Waternet generates roughly 400 million a year, was generated digitally, so via an online channel, which is really big, as most of these people in these agile teams were just obviously that would do them little justice, but what were regular government employees that have worked there for 10 to 20 to for 30 years. I don't believe that in order to change, you first need completely different people. That's a very, probably it's an effective way of changing, but it's also very easy and not very likely within government surroundings. So the regular workforce just working in a different way, namely agile, that was able to create this kind of results. And customer satisfaction rose from, I think, a 6.2 to somewhere over the 8. So from average to excellent and above.
That's really great. And you said like you do the same kind of workforce. Mm-hmm. Like, did you train them or did you just put them into the position that they needed to act? So actually learning on the job, was there?
Well, the framework was very simple. There were two principles. If you understand what it's about, then you're allowed to make a decision. So if you don't understand what it's about, then you're not. So every employee that wanted to get involved in website design or information architecture or development first had to find a suitable education or course or even full skill master training, whatever they felt it was their ambition to start deciding upon. And they were all paid for by Waternet. We had an unlimited coaching budget or an unlimited education budget. And Scrum Masters had the full authority to plan this in. So when a random team member said, I want to have a basic training in skilled agile, and I want to know how UXing works or front-end design, then that's fine. Then you're going on training the next sprint. But this will also be added to your skill set, so we also expect something from you now, that you use or leverage these skills. Most boards think, well, two things happen. First is the education budget will probably go through the roof. And the second is everyone will go on random, very, very irrelevant education, which is, of course, both not true. No one in his right mind will spend 10 days within a warm classroom for something that he's not going to use, especially adults. Come on, what are we? And obviously, no one in their right mind will spend 100,000 euros per person on education. People can be trusted to not make completely insane decisions. It's not that being a board member or being a manager gives you a sort of a special rationality that only you can use, and only you can foresee that these things are not very, very handy. Your employees can make roughly the same decisions, but usually faster because they were the bigger group. So we tended to trust our employees to make these decisions for themselves. And we had a completely radical transparency feedback structure. So every result or every activity just went on a sticky, on a post-it on the wall in order to give each other feedback. So it wasn't free, it wasn't form-free or without any management guidance. But it was all based on transparency. So if you feel that you should deserve this education, that's fine. Just put it on a post-it, put it on the wall, and make others believe that your choice was the right one.
And what did it do with the employee satisfaction?
Because this was something that did went through the roof, because suddenly they became important, and their well-being and their strategic growth became the primary driver that changed an agile team that was just being on its bike for the first time to agile teams that were actually riding the Tour de France, to stick with my earlier metaphor. So obviously the employee satisfaction, I think it hovered around the 8.5. And I used to say when it's lower than an 8, I'll leave. Because I think if you have such a big transformation, we thought you don't have a feeling that this is an awesome gig that is really triggering the best in us, then I as a manager, I'm not doing it right. And this was all obviously this all sounds a lot, which it is, but the important thing to remember is that it became a lot. It became, to use another metaphor, like a snowball that you throw down a hill, and that halfway down the hill is a Lewin, at the end of the hill is a completely giant Lewin. At the beginning, we didn't really know that this was possible. This was just a small snowball rolling down. It became possible because so many people, these 40 teams, started joining and started developing new ways of how we could cooperate, or developing new ways that we could train each other or give feedback to each other. So it became big. It wasn't a megalomaniac idea in my head. It just, I'm not going to say it span out of control, but it grew really well.
And then what were the main success factors for yourself? Like, what do you think? I know this is a successful project, and it's also seen like that in the Netherlands. So what made it a success?
Well, I learned, even though I have the position to make the decision, and when I really want to, people won't go into my decision, that's probably not a basis to make a lot of decisions. So you really have to understand where a strategic decision is needed. And this usually revolves around keeping ourselves to principle. So are we able to stay the course in terms of principle realization? Are we able to stay close to what we think is ultimately best, regardless of current setbacks or current hiccups? And all other things were usually something that someone else was better in designing. In order to teach me that, because I can be quite dominant, so this was not a very natural thing for me to realize, was our feedback culture. So every team ended their sprint with a really solid retrospective, really evaluating how did the past few weeks go, what can we learn from it, what can we learn from intercooperation. But things really went fast when we started to scale up these retrospectives, when we had cross-team or cross-domain or cross-business, and in the end, cross-Waternet evaluations. So now every 3 months, all leadership, all product owners, all teams of the whole of Waternet sit in one giant room that's now roughly 400 or 500 people.
Yep.
And they evaluate how the last 3 weeks went and what do they need to do to improve the following 3 weeks. And it has become very normal to say to the CIO, I want you to do this, and the CIO to say to you, that's very fine, I want you to do that, and that's the way that we help each other to further our mission.
So as such, the whole project also defined a kind of new culture within Waternet.
Yeah, definitely. But it also fitted our culture, because Waternet is an engineering company that really likes to make things, to improve things, and fix things along the way. And a lot of engineering cultures have that. And fixing things goes better when you're in a team and when you're able to say to each other, well, you made this, but it's not really good, shall we try something new? And when you hear it, you say it yourself, it's not really good. So we try something new. And then, and the even more question, important question was, will you help me or can I help you? Then it's not that hard. It's not that strange to suddenly find these principles important. And the concerning bit is, in a lot of organizations, these questions have become very strange. It has become very strange to say, can you help me or can I help you? Or it has become strange to say, this is not very good, but can I help you fix it? Or will you fix it? And this is something that I at some point it became hard to understand why this was the case when we started. But now, from a Deloitte perspective, obviously I see this is a lot because I see a lot of different organizations now. And now it's hard to explain them that there's no need to keep each other in a sort of a stranglehold of fear and mutual attraction and you know, all these complicated things that large organizations tend to imagine they need to achieve a certain goal.
Did it in the end also resulted in a kind of different organizational structure? Or is it stay the same? Or?
No, we had a, especially in the IT department, we had quite a strong strategy club and a place where lots of planning was done and release management and process management. But within a skilled Agile framework, most processes, so almost every, let's say 90% of all relevant processes, are being done by the teams themselves. So most of these roles disappeared, which I think was roughly 40-50% of the IT employee base, and they taught themselves something else. So
they actually reskilled themselves and went on working in one of the Agile teams.
Yeah,
somewhere else?
Yeah, because Watnet used a sort of a job market. So at the end of every sprint, every team decided for themselves after its practice, wow, we need a certain skill and we need something that will either want to learn this skill or already has this skill, and they posted an opening on the job market. And it became very normal for people to continuously rotate jobs across different teams. So they tried web development for a few months and then went on to do testing for a few months. And it didn't really matter because the teams were themselves responsible for the initial output. And because it's also transparent, it's very, very easy to see which team is just a very fun place to work but not really effective, and which team is very effective might want to be more flexible in the type of people they attract. So this job market carousel or job carousel, whatever, can't remember what we called it, became about because we made a split between job and function. And function is something that's protected by your contract with you and Watnet. And that's something, especially in government, that is ironclad, can't really fire you, whatever you want. So that's something that we're not even going to touch. We're not going to enter a very long discussion with OER whether or not we want to fire you or not, or whether or not you need new skills or not. That's all fine and well, so you're protected, so no fear there. But we are going to ask you, will you consider different roles? And this was the split. So the job market was actually a role market. Will you, as your function information architect, will try the role lead developer for a few months to see if you like it? And if you don't like it, just go back to your function or to any other team. Everything is safe. There's no harm there. It's all about fear. But if you do like it, would you please become very good at it and help your team grow faster? And that was a good way of involving the OR, which is in English the Employee Council, in this change. Instead of seeing them as a competitor or a difficult stakeholder, they became a partner in this transformation because they often gave solid feedback about things that I or my colleagues didn't pick up on. And as everything was transparent, this also went on the board and we discussed it in the annual evaluation rhythm to what to do with the feedback that was provided.
Were there any big failures in the whole thing that you say, well, that was really a failure that we learned a lot from? Or
yeah, obviously, yeah. Yeah. I think I went on an Agile training and I learned that code branching, I don't know where you know what it is, but it's when you work on different sets, subsets of the same code base, of the same application or application chain, was something that you should avoid at all costs within Scrum. So you have to have teams that are as autonomous as possible, and integration should be feared. So I said, no integration, because I'm a manager, I can decide that this is best, no integration. And obviously, at a point in time, integration is inevitable because your functionality needs to cooperate. Yeah. And I've learned that by saying that integration is forbidden under all circumstances, that I've just made the problem a whole lot worse, because they went 4 or 5 sprints within completely opposite directions, had to rework roughly everything, and ended with a sticky on the evaluation wall that, no, if I put it very nicely, it said, Mario, please don't bother becoming too involved with code, because you don't understand it and you make things worse. But part of an open culture is that I am an adult enough to take this sticky, put it over my bed at home, and think, has been a very costly lesson, might not want to do this again.
That's a great story. I understood that there's also a kind of article where this is highlighted, this project.
So we especially I end up it, but most of what it likes to tell about what's happening and what's still happening even after I left. So that's a to my opinion a very good thing. And we told a lot of it to Gartner, the sort of international IT research agency, research corporation, whatever you want to call it. And they published an article on scaling enterprise agility and named Waternet as a best reference, as a reference case. This is how you should do it within if you want to involve your people and want to go somewhere really fast without all these complicated transformation plans and whatnot. And this is obviously the thing that I'm trying to teach or advise clients right now is when it feels complicated, that's probably because you made it too complicated. You can start smaller and you're not doing it wrong, then you're just learning something. And the question is more, am I learning enough? And am I able to translate this learning, for instance, via governance, to the rest of my organization, than making big plans about complicated things that we lack experience to really understand how complicated they are. So better organize your learning experience than organize your design phase.
I think this is a very good ending of our conversation. Thank you. And so if people want to know more, they can probably look and find via Google the piece from Gartner, yep, where you are mentioned.
Yep.
And maybe if they want to know more, they can always reach out to you.
So, sure. Yeah. Obviously.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. We hope you found it inspiring. Don't forget to rate us so we can learn what we need to do better in the future. And of course, if you like the podcast, please share. Follow us as we will publish more inspiring stories on public sector innovation soon. We wish you a great day, and if you want to join the conversation, please visit our website on www.deloitte.nl/govlab.